Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, hour two is here, believe it or not. And the number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. You can call now. We do have a line or two open. If you get a busy signal, just hit redial, and we'll work on getting you in. Let's go to Joe now in Passaic, New Jersey. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Patrick. As always, I always have to thank God, thank Relevant Radio, thank you, and thank you to Franciscan Friars in Patterson for showing me the way
I'm
to
glad
the road
you
ahead.
Know them. Awesome.
Thank you for that. Okay, question about Hebrews 9:27. Just put in two words, it says that you're going to die once. But then it seems like in 1 Corinthians 15:51, Paul says there's a secret, not everyone will die. Is that a contradiction, or am I just not getting it?
Well, no, it's not a contradiction. In Hebrews 9:27, it's telling us that all of us in this mortal life will have an end to our mortal life and then we'll be judged. But in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, St. Paul, I think, gives us the answer to your question. He says that when the Lord returns, I just want to open to this passage so that I can read it to you verbatim rather than try to quote it by memory. So here's what he says. Let's see. He says, okay, for since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, this is verse 14, even so through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. For this we declare to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive, now think about what he's saying here. This is at the end, okay? We who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, shall not precede those who have fallen asleep, that is, those who have died. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the archangel's call, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. So as I see it, the answer to your question is that not every single last person is going to die. There will be some who are still alive in this world when the Lord returns. But although they won't experience death in the way that everyone else does, they will be changed or translated from mortal life into immortality. So those who are caught up in the air, this is the rapture that the Bible speaks about, not a pre-tribulation rapture, but the final last day. They don't die, strictly speaking, but they're changed. So they're now immortal. They go into the afterlife. Mm-hmm. How exactly that works, I don't know. But I think that's the way to answer the question, is that Hebrews 9:27 isn't, you know, every last single person, because we know these people.
So it's like a pejorative. Instead of saying 9,999,000 out of a million are going to die, and one isn't. So it's just easier to say all will die.
Maybe. But the more I think about it, though, I mean, pejorative is not really the right word for that. But it's kind of like in a way where it says that in Romans 5 that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. St. Paul returns to this theme in Romans 3 and Romans 5. Well, I mean, not literally every person sinned, because there are whole groups of people who never had an opportunity to commit a sin, like children who die in the womb, for example. They never sinned.
Gotcha.
And he's not talking there about original sin, the condition of original sin. He's talking about actual sin. So there's an example of where when the Bible says all have sinned, it doesn't mean strictly or absolutely every single last person, but it's a way of describing the vast majority of humanity.
All right. I guess I was basically on the right track here. All right.
I think you were. So are the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal treating you right? I mean, that's a dumb question because they're great.
That was, Those guys are wonderful. Those guys are just wonderful. They always have time for confession, never an excuse.
That's so
they're
great.
Just great guys.
Yeah, they really are. And it's nice that they're in your backyard. You can drive there. Now, do you go to Yonkers? Oh, that's pretty far up the river, but do you go to in the city, or where do you visit them?
Paterson.
Oh, in Paterson.
St. Michael's. Paterson, New Jersey, and then what I do is I work there every other week. They do food distribution, so I help out there a little bit in cleaning up the property and things like that. So
awesome.
A little bit of return for what they do.
Well, that's cool. I'm sure they like having you around, Joe. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Bernine now in Dwight, Illinois. Hi, Bernine.
Good morning. My question is, I have a friend who married a Lebanese man, and they belong to, if I get it right, it's the Assyrian Apostolic Catholic Church of the East.
Okay.
And to my knowledge, they're not in full communion with Rome, but I don't know what the differences are. I know it's an ancient church, but I believe they believe a heresy from many, many centuries ago.
Well, I don't have deep knowledge about this particular group. I'm looking at their website, and they are billed as Syriac Christian, and they, you know, it just gives a lot of information about their, you know, their presence and their, you know, their history as I go through this. So without knowing anything in more detail, I wouldn't want to try to wing it and tell you things about a group that I don't have specific information about. But if you look them up, I mean, you could go to their website, you know, and read all that. So AssyrianChurch.org is their website. I also notice as I scroll through that there's also a Wikipedia entry for them as well. And I just opened that up, and that's quite extensive as well. So, I mean, if you're looking for...
Yeah, but they're not going to tell us what heresy that they might hold that is going to vary from the Catholic Church.
Okay. Maybe they won't. But, I mean, are you... How did you hear that they hold heresy?
Oh, I believe I had spoke many moons ago with a Maronite rite priest. And he did... tell me what it was, and I can't remember what it was.
You're probably, and by the way, it's the Maronite rite, not Maronite rite.
Maronite rite.
Yeah. They probably would be really happy to hear it pronounced as Maronite. but yeah, so I'm taking a shot in the dark here, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was Nestorianism, which was an early Christological heresy. And it was held, and maybe in fact is held, it still is held, along with the Monophysite heresy by some of the churches. So, for example, the Coptic Orthodox Church has been accused of holding the Monophysite heresy. And these heresies are very similar, but they're related to each other, but they're different. So the Monophysite heresy, it could have been that one too, that's the heresy that Christ had only one nature, and he, in fact, has two natures. He's divine and human. The issue of Nestorianism is related to that, and this idea in Nestorianism is that Jesus, that he had a distinct human nature and a distinct divine nature because he is both a human person and a divine person. And that's not true either. So Jesus is one person, the divine person, but he has a human nature and a divine nature. So I'm not sure which of those might be, you know, they might be tagging this Assyrian Orthodox Church or Assyrian Apostolic Church.
Sounds familiar.
Is that okay? So, but as I say, since I don't have any deep knowledge about this particular group, I can't say, oh, it's this. But I mean,
right. That
would be something you could inquire about. What is your interest in them? Is there a church near you that they? I mean, have you talked to people?
No, it's just a high school friend of mine. she's been going to that church, and I mean, she has no problem coming to the Catholic Church with me, and she believes in the true presence and everything. She was actually raised Episcopal, but you know, her daughter is asking questions now, and maybe looking at something, maybe looking at the Catholic Church as opposed to where she has been raised.
Right. Well, I think that it would be good for you to, you know, obviously reach out to her and ask her if she has any questions, if she'd like to know more. I mean, if you want something that will give you an overview of these different heresies, Hilaire Belloc wrote one on the great heresies. Now, that's a macro look at the like bigger picture issues, but that would be a place you could get some information. I mean, you could get information online. You could look that up and read on an online encyclopedia or even Wikipedia for that matter. There's a classic book. I think it's still in print. It's called A History of Heresies by David Christie Murray, who I believe was an Anglican priest or an Anglican scholar. But it's a survey of the early church, primarily the early church heresies. So Montanism and Arianism and Nestorianism and Pelagianism and all those isms he takes a look at, and I found it very interesting from an historical standpoint. Hilda Graeff has a book on the survey of heresies in the early church. She was a Catholic author. I don't know if that book's still in print, though. But those are some sources you could turn to. Oh, and you know, it would be remiss of me not to add Catholic Answers, now that I think about it. Catholic Answers has a wide variety of information, magazine articles, tracts, and other things that will give you even more detail on these various heresies if you're interested.
Okay.
All right. There you go. Glad I could help. Thank you. Let's go now to Patrick in Monterey, California. Good morning, Patrick.
Yeah. In the Faustina prayer, we say, Eternal Father, we offer up the body and blood, soul and divinity, etc. And I don't understand that. You know, and I asked Drew Mariani, and he didn't really get it either. What am I doing there?
Well, I'm sure Drew knows this. I know Drew well, and I know he knows this. So maybe it didn't translate well on the radio. I don't know. But it simply means that we, as lay people and having the priesthood of all believers by virtue of our baptism, that we participate in the holy sacrifice of the Mass. We're not spectators, we're participants. Now, the priest is the priest who's offering the sacrifice on the altar. This is the once-for-all sacrifice of Christ. It can't be repeated. And he is acting in this role of in persona Christi, in altar Christus, to use those Latin phrases that means he's acting in the person of Christ at the altar, and we participate in that. So because there's only one sacrifice of Jesus for our salvation once for all, every time you're at Mass, or for that matter, when you're praying and uniting yourself, such as in the Divine Mercy prayer, you are participating with the whole church in offering the body, blood, soul, and divinity to the Father, which is the essence of the Mass. And it's the same as the Blessed Virgin Mary and St. John and St. Mary Magdalene and the others who were standing at the foot of the cross. They were there not only to see what happened, but they were also participating in their grief and in their prayers and in their union with Jesus in his sufferings. And we are in the same role of offering it that way.
I get that. So you're saying we are participating, it's a private devotion. So you're saying we're participating in the Mass somehow, spiritually?
In a certain sense, you could say that, yeah. Insofar as it's an invocation in that prayer, we offer the body, blood, soul, and divinity is a way of saying that we are uniting ourselves, not just with the Mass per se, but think of it this way, Patrick. This may be more helpful. Remember how Jesus said, I am the vine and you are the branches? And St. Paul said that the church is the body of Christ and we're all members of the body. So because we have this inextricable union with the Lord as members of his body, he, as our priest and victim, offering himself as a perfect sacrifice to the Father. And this is an eternal priesthood. We're told in Hebrews that it's a priesthood that never passes away, which means that Christ, our high priest, is in heaven eternally presenting his offering on our behalf to the Father. So as members of the body of Christ, we're participating in that. We're not causing it to happen, but we participate in it because we are in Christ, in his body. And therefore, as he makes this priestly sacrificial offering to the Father, we unite our wills with him. We unite our minds and our hearts and our desire to participate in that sacrifice. It's in that sense that the prayer is referring to that. And that, of course, includes the Mass, maybe most concretely.
Yeah. That's more satisfactory. Very good. All right. Have a good day.
Thank you. And Drew Mariani is a walking encyclopedia when it comes to things pertaining to, well, a lot of things, but certainly when it comes to the Divine Mercy devotion. So I will gladly take a backseat to Drew any day of the week when it comes to his knowledge of the Divine Mercy prayers and the whole phenomenon. Let's see. Time? Yeah, we have time. Let's go to Anna now in Miami. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question. I've been a Catholic since, I don't know, I was born. And I've never, I just, you know, we don't question. It's like, whatever, that's how our faith grows. recently I've heard that when we take the communion, it should not be in the hand. And that's a very typical trend, you know, where I see a lot of people take it in the hand. I do. I don't know if it's wrong. My neighbor says it is. She has a book that she's ordering. Apparently it's in Spanish, but she says it explains how you should not touch it. It can only come from the consecrated hands of the priest, and that's it. So I don't know if I'm doing anything wrong.
Well, let's look at that. First of all, the Church since Vatican II has relaxed what once was regarded to be a liturgical abuse of lay people receiving Holy Communion in the hand, and the Church has permitted it. I remember in the early 90s when I went on my very first visit to Rome, and I had a number of meetings in the Vatican. I mean, they had no clue who I was, but I was just kind of getting started. But I was invited to attend Pope John Paul II's private Mass in the morning. My colleague and I, we were invited to do this. And when we got there early in the morning, we were told that if the Holy Father was going to distribute Holy Communion, and it turns out he didn't. He might have been feeling unwell that day, so another priest or a bishop gave communion. But we were told, don't hold your hands out because he's not going to give you communion on the hand because he frowns on that. And naturally, I mean, we didn't do that. But even so, I never receive communion on the hand myself. I only receive on the tongue. But my point is that what once was regarded as a liturgical abuse, even though you can find some vestiges of this practice in the early church, you can see some of the church fathers, really only a couple, who refer to it. And one of whom says it very clearly, to make your hand into a throne, put one hand palm facing up on the other hand so as to receive Holy Communion. So we know that it was practiced in some ways in the early church, but that fell out of practice. And for a long time, well over 1,000 years, the custom was not to receive Holy Communion in the hand, but to receive it on the tongue. So my point in going into all that detail is to say you're not doing anything contrary to what the church permits. The church says you can do that. And so if that's, you know, the concern of yours, I think maybe the deeper issue is, even though the church permits it, is it better, is it more in keeping with showing reverence to the Lord to receive Holy Communion on the tongue? Now, my personal point of view is that, yes, that's a superior way to do it. That's a preferable way to do it, but it's not a required way to do it. And you mentioned the consecrated hands of the priest. That's exactly one of the reasons why, for the longest time, the church did not permit lay people to receive Holy Communion in the hand. In fact, in the Eastern churches, it's absolutely unthinkable to receive Holy Communion in the hand. And part of the reason is because they commingle the Eucharistic bread and the precious blood into a chalice, and they give it to you in a spoon. But that notwithstanding, the point is that the priest's hands are consecrated for sacrifice at the altar. And the church's theology of holy orders, and in particular the priesthood, and her theology of the Mass and her theology of the Holy Eucharist as such, is inextricably connected to the fact that this priest has been set apart from the priesthood of all believers, which you and I possess as well as baptized members of the church. He now has received a special character, a special dimension, you might say, of priesthood, which is to offer sacrifice. And that is unique and distinct. And so the church historically has recognized that there is a certain impropriety. It's not that it can never be done. So let's say that a catechist or a sacristan in some remote part of the world where there is no priest and there won't be any priest anytime soon, the church foresees these situations and says, yeah, under some circumstances, lay people can and even should distribute Holy Communion and touch the host. It's not as though it's a sin to do so. But what is the appropriate way of doing this under normal circumstances? And what I'm trying to say, Anna, is that traditionally, it was for these reasons that that lay people were not to touch the host. But now the church says it's okay. So I don't want you to feel as though you're going contrary to what the church permits. That may change in the future, but for the time being, at least, it is permitted.
Okay. All right. I don't know. Thank you so much for that explanation.
You're welcome.
I don't know if I have a lot of time. I mean, I originally have two questions, and the second one was, if you have the time, if not, it's okay.
Well, how about this? Oh, I hear the music. Forgive me. I hear the music. That means I do have to take a break. How about this, Anna? Let's take a rain check on the second question and maybe call me back next week and we'll pick it up from there. Sound good?
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. Look forward to it. Thank you. All right. I'll be right back. Enjoy some Cars music and I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149.
You got it.
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
You like it?
You got it.
Hey, by the way, I promised, well, I didn't really promise, I guess, but I had a lively conversation with Jim in California about the difference of opinion that we have on whether or not the apostles were ordained to the priesthood at the Last Supper. And Jim had said that he wants to see it in black and white in some Catholic authoritative source. And so I had a little time during the break, and I have it for you. And I don't know if you're still listening, Jim, but if you are, one of those sources would be the Council of Trent, and this is in its section on the Sacrament of Holy Orders, Session 22, Section 1. It says, if anyone shall say that by the words, do this in commemoration of me, which Jesus uttered at the Last Supper, that Christ did not institute the apostles as priests, or did not ordain that they and other priests should offer his body and blood, let him be anathema. So, simply put, that is the teaching of the church. I didn't have my finger on that particular passage, but hopefully that will answer the question that you asked me. And also, it anathematizes people who deny that at the Last Supper, Jesus ordained the priests, the apostles rather, to the priesthood. So I hope that's sufficient evidence to make that point, and I'm glad you called me. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Amy now in Clearwater, Minnesota. Hi, Amy.
Good morning.
Hello, Amy. Yes. Welcome.
I have a comment. Thank you. I have a comment regarding Roe versus Wade.
Okay.
Yesterday, you had a gentleman on who was talking about a family who had a child with significant health problems. and he wanted openness to.
Oh, the doctor. Yeah.
Correct.
I forget his name,
right.
But yes, I remember him. Mm-hmm.
So my thinking is it's taken us 50 years to get to this very difficult culture of death. And if I'm correct, I think Roe versus Wade, they wanted abortions like from 0 to 3 months of the pregnancy term, or from conception to 3 months.
Okay.
But now, I mean, abortion has gotten so so ugly, you know, with the late terms and other things.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, my thought is, if it's taken us 50 years to get to this point, to not be able to see that a life is a life, it's going to take us 50 years to reclaim that ground.
Maybe.
I mean, everybody who's, you know, 60 and below has lived with this pretty much their whole life.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, and true. I mean, in it may be 50, maybe 100 years.
I
don't really know. I mean, I'd like to see it. I'd like to see hearts and minds change much sooner than that. But
me too, but we're pretty thick-headed.
Yeah.
I have friends who, I have two family friends that have children with Down syndrome and another friend with spina bifida.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no better time to have these children because there's so much help for these parents. And we know so much more about raising little ones that there's no reason to abort if you're given a diagnosis.
No. That's right. Well, maybe you sound like a young woman, Amy, so maybe you'll live to see 50 years from now what people's opinions about abortion are. I'm not going to see that if it takes 50 years.
Well,
so let's
I'm
hope
55.
It's faster. Well, you might live to be very old.
I'm 55. I've got 4 kids, 2 adopted, 2 bio. And
yeah.
I think the culture up for adoption also needs to be much more open-minded.
It's a person-specific thing, isn't it? Where we have to change people's hearts and minds one by one, person-specific. You can't change, you know, half the country all at once.
No.
It has to proliferate. But that's one reason. It's one really big reason, if you ask me, why Relevant Radio is here and why what we do here is so needed right now. Because there are plenty of people, Amy, who are, or at least they think they are, in favor of abortion until maybe they start listening, maybe by chance, to something on Relevant Radio. They just happen across the station. They didn't even know it was there. They start listening. We've had people call in or even write in and tell us that very thing happened, that it changed their minds. People, women, men, who say, I used to be adamantly pro-abortion, pro-choice, as they would call it, and I changed my mind. I did a 180 when I finally began to think about it and hear some common sense information from the other side. So I know it happens. And that gives me a lot of hope and encouragement that maybe it'll take 50 years, but Relevant Radio's in it for the long haul, please God.
Oh, I think we all are. I mean, all of us who truly believe in life. I mean, we've prayed our way to this point, and now is the time for...
Yeah.
I'm 55, so people younger than us to step up to put their name out there to say, I will adopt
mm-hmm.
these unwanted children, and so that no child goes without a family.
Yeah. Amy, are you by chance familiar with Virtue Media and their television commercials that are pro-life?
I have seen some of them, yes.
Okay. I love talking about them. I don't have any connection to them, but I'm a big fan of their commercials, that, and they're all available at, so virtuemedia.org. And there's an example of what can be done to change people's hearts without propaganda, without rhetoric, without, you know, facts and statistics and things that people can close their minds to. These 30-second commercials get right to the heart. And I'm glad you raised this issue, Amy, because I'd like to springboard off what you said to introduce maybe people listening right now who are not familiar with Virtue Media so that they will become familiar with these and watch some of these commercials, highly produced, great production values. They air them on secular stations and secular networks when there's funding for it, and they're really effective. They're the same people behind Catholics Come Home, two different organizations, but the same people who do both. So that's one way that we can concretely reach out to people at the heart level. Well, Amy, thank you. And I appreciate the phone call and getting a chance to talk about those details. And speaking of the gentleman that Amy is referring to, his name is David. He called yesterday. And if you heard the call, he mentioned that he's a physician. And he mentioned that he's a former Catholic. We didn't go into that issue at all. But we had a lively conversation on why, in my view, it is immoral to commit an abortion. Why is it immoral? Because it's an innocent human life. He, of course, was taking the opposite view. And several people wrote in because they found that conversation very, very helpful. And I'm glad of that. So another person wrote in. I think this came in yesterday. It actually came in this morning. This is from Jack, who's listening on the Relevant Radio app. And Jack, thank you for the email. He says, Patrick, David, the gentleman who called in toward the end of yesterday's program, was, to put it mildly, very unsettling. His views on the inherent value of any life are especially chilling because he is a physician. He seemed to be saying that abortion is A-OK when the expected child would be inconvenient to somebody, a burden to either the mother or society. His choice of words, even for a newborn, were very callous indeed. You can hand it off much as you would a football. Though he may well be a fine doctor, technically, he sorely lacks the compassion that should be the hallmark of his profession. Patrick, he says, you should be proud of how you handled him. Well, it was a lively phone call, that's for sure. And I appreciate the kind word there, Jack. Thank you. But one thing is certain, and that is that David's phone call was a high watermark for many people. And if you heard it, and if you didn't hear it, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. And go to, was it the second hour? I think it was, maybe it was toward the end of the third hour, I forget. But you'll see in the show notes. And I would encourage you, listen to that phone call. Listen to what that gentleman was saying. Listen to his effort to sort of logically, I guess, try to defend his position. And if you've ever wondered, how can you as a pro-life person, how can you have a dialogue with somebody? And in this case, I mean, he's a physician, so he's got scientific cred. He's got the training. He's got the background that I don't have. I'm not a physician. You know, I only got an A in chemistry because my dad said I couldn't get my driver's license unless I got an A in chemistry. So that's the extent of my scientific background. But even somebody like that, don't be buffaloed. Don't be cowed or intimidated by somebody who's got degrees and experience and knowledge that you don't have, if the argument is not won or lost on the basis of that scientific knowledge, if it's won or lost on the issue of, is this a person? Is this a human being? And although science, of course, can tell us a great deal about the process of and the development of unborn human beings, it's an established fact that life begins at conception. And so that is what human beings look like at each stage of development along the way. And so if you've ever wondered, how can you handle yourself in a conversation with somebody who takes a diametrically opposite view, maybe you should listen to that particular phone call. I think it's very instructive. And you'll be able to see a lot of these kind of flaws in reasoning and leaps of illogic. And I'm not saying that to be, you know, in any way derogatory toward him. I'm sure he's a nice guy, and I bet he really believes that he has thought this through carefully. I don't think he has, and I think that's evidenced by what you hear in the conversation, but that's up to you to decide. I'm obviously biased because I think it's a slam dunk. You know, it's easy to cinch the case that unborn life deserves our protection. Not everybody feels that way. But if you want to know how to go into a conversation and be able to make some points along the way, that might be a good place to go. All right, why don't we take a break and we'll come back and we will go right back to your phone calls. I also have plenty more emails to get to, and I'm going to try to do some of those as well today. All right, you're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. I'm here for you, so if you want to call me, my number is 888-914-9149. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio. Don't get
me wrong. Well, I am here for you, and we have an hour and 15 minutes, roughly, yet to go. Governor Newsom, he is being accused of hypocrisy, according to the Washington Times. He's being accused of hypocrisy this time for vacationing in Montana, which is a state that is subject to California's stupid ban on official travel. The Democrat and his family are spending the week in the Big Sky State, one of 20 states which state-sponsored travel is prohibited based on their discriminatory laws, quote-unquote, against LGBTQ people. The ban under AB 1887 covers state-paid travel, not privately funded trips, but the governor was nonetheless ripped on social media for the trek to allegedly discriminatory Montana after it was first reported. Republican communications strategist Andrew Clark says these silly state travel bans are Democratic virtue signaling at its worst. If Newsom truly believes Montana is so awful that state employees should be banned from traveling there, why is he vacationing in Montana for the week? So make of it what you will, but I think it's yet another example of do as I say and not as I do, which is not uncommon in politics. But, you know, I'm sure that we will be seeing Governor Newsom make a run for the presidency. And that's something to keep in mind maybe when the issue comes up. Also, this is from the Huffington Post, and it's not a source that I typically turn to, but I thought you might find this interesting nonetheless. Former Secretary of Education Bill Bennett, during a press appearance, suggested that expelling demons could be a way to cut back on mass shootings. Now, you may say, oh, come on. Well, think about this for a minute. He was the education secretary under President Ronald Reagan. And he was commenting on what are known as red flag laws, like those in Illinois, that are designed to keep guns out of the hands of people who are deemed to be a danger to themselves or others. The question comes just days after a mass shooting at a parade in Highland Park, Illinois, which left seven people dead and dozens of others wounded. The site of this shooting, by the way, was not very far from our headquarters at Relevant Radio. I mean, we were nowhere near that. And I don't mean to suggest that any of the Relevant Radio people were in any danger or anything, but this terrible massacre that took place was in suburbia. Wasn't downtown Chicago or anything like that. It was about the most idyllic small town, Mayberry RFD kind of place that you could imagine. And so for what it's worth, it was shockingly close to where we are. But in any case, in that shooting, which, as you know, seven people were killed and dozens were injured. The context of this conversation that Bill Bennett was having was got to the question of, like, what are the causes of this stuff? Like I was saying yesterday or the day before, I forget which. America has always been a gun culture, always. It was like every other country back in the day when everybody had guns because most people were not living in the cities. Most people were living on farms, and so they had to hunt for food, and they had to protect themselves. And so guns have always been part of the culture in the United States. Now, it's evolved, obviously, in different ways. But the point is, we didn't have mass shootings in the United States. Let's say, and I'm going to throw a dart here, I'd like to see some specific data that would confirm this, but I'm going to go out on a limb here and say roughly 50 years ago and before. I know there was the shooting in Austin, Texas from the tower on the campus. I know there were some here and there, but by all comparison, there is no comparison to the number of mass shootings that we have today on a nearly, at times, daily basis, practically, certainly on a weekly basis. We get numb to it. I don't know if you feel like you can't keep up with all of them. One of them is so shocking, and then before you know it, there's another one, then another one, then another one. And after a while, you start forgetting some of the details because there's just so many of them. So point being simply this, something changed in this country, and it wasn't guns. It wasn't as though we didn't used to have guns all over the place and everybody, you know, or many, many people had them. That was a fact then without the mass shootings. Now we're having these mass shootings. So it leads back to what William Bennett had to say on this issue. I don't think it's untoward to point out that some people are diabolically possessed. Some people have demonic possession. I remember talking to, and I'm trying now to remember exactly who it was, because this is going back some years. So forgive me if I can't recall immediately who it was, but it was some figure who was a public speaker and maybe an author and a Catholic, but who had lived a rather dissipated life of hedonism and drug abuse and sexual promiscuity and just kind of insane stuff. And he was sharing with me about how there was this one kind of, I think it was may have been a party scenario, but like a big house, lots and lots of people there. And he, at this time in his life, was deeply into all of this bad stuff that he was doing. He was into the drugs. He was into rampant sexual promiscuity. He was doing all kinds of things that you know you're not supposed to do. And he was in the middle of all that, far from God, didn't pray, didn't have anything. And he told me, he says, I think I was this close, this far away from becoming demonically possessed because that at some point that night when he was in this party house, he walked past a room. And don't worry, parents, I'm not going to say anything graphic or titillating, but he walked past a room and he saw a woman lying unconscious on a bed. And he said that he had this overwhelming, sudden, it wasn't coming from him, but he felt like there was this overwhelming and sudden demand being asked of him to kill her. Go kill her. Kill that woman. Kill her. Go in there and kill her. And he said it was it made the hair on the back of his neck go up because he felt this is the devil here and now wanting to take total control of me. And the way to do it is for me to obey and go in and follow those terrible commands to go in and kill this woman. Now, obviously, he didn't do that. And he left and he ran away. And as he told me the story, he said that was sort of the beginning of him turning back toward God because he realized just how close and powerful this demonic presence was and also just how easily he could have followed those suggestions, those commands, and gone in and done that. And he said he believed that he would have become demonically possessed. And that is not at all far-fetched, as exorcists will tell you. Diabolical possession, it, as I understand it, just learning from the exorcists who have written on this topic, it's usually, maybe almost always even, it's the result of a series of compromises, smaller things, then a little bit bigger things, a little bit bigger things, a little bit bigger things. Eventually, it's just like the flick of a finger, and the devil has everything he needs to be able to possess that person in the fullest sense, because there are lesser degrees of diabolical interference. So that has always stuck in my mind. And that's why when I saw this story in the Huffington Post about what Bill Bennett had said, and a lot of people are scoffing at that, like, oh, come on, you Jesus freak, what's wrong with you? If you're going to look at the causes for these mass shootings, let's look at violent video games. Let's look at the culture of death, as Pope John Paul II described it, which certainly includes abortion and euthanasia. Let's look at the nihilism and the appetite for destruction that we see rampant in certain forms of music that are very popular, violence and promotion of violence and promotion of killing and the glorification of these things. There are a lot of factors, I think, that feed into this, the psychotropic drugs, you know, the ways in which people's minds are altered as a result of medicines and substance addiction and things. So I think there's a witch's brew of things that didn't, for all intents and purposes, exist 50, 60 years ago, 70 years ago. They didn't exist. They certainly didn't exist in the form that we know them today. And yes, I think there is a distinct role for diabolical possession, or at least diabolical interference. And the evil one trying to get people to do insane things, just the heinous crimes, like go into that room and kill that woman. Do it right now. Go kill her. Go kill her. That's what this man was experiencing, this voice telling him. What happens if you're some crazed guy and you've got guns and you've got, you know, already this addled way of looking at the world, and there is a diabolical presence urging you to go do that? Some of these people are going to go do that. So I'll leave it at this. Yeah, there's definitely room for trying to treat this problem at its root. And one of those roots, it seems to me, is diabolical possession, or at least some form of diabolical interference. So are exorcisms a solution? I think partly, yeah. I think it could only help, if you ask me. All right. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Mary in Bozeman, Montana. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you talking about this topic. I just wanted to quickly say before I get to my question that I think it involves early intervention with our young guys mm-hmm. who are, you know, on the internet way too much, games, porn, all this yeah. crap that's, you know, feeding that evil thread that's weaving through our society. And so really we need to tag these kids and get them into some sort of wraparound intervention. And the other problem we have is that the police or the law will not step in until something happens. So you can go and you can complain and you can be concerned and want and on, but what you're going to be told is that we cannot do anything to John Smith until he commits something.
Yeah, if I can interject, Mary, I agree with what you're saying. I think that we should really demand that the social media companies, they have a role to play in this. And if some guy is posting pictures of himself shooting people, or if he's ideating this idea of killing people, shooting people, I mean, that right there is enough of a red flag where somebody needs to go and look at that and find out, do we have a future mass shooter on our hands? It doesn't mean that in every case it does, but that seems to be a common thread in all of these things, that they all seemed to be giving warning signs on social media, at least in recent years, kind of telling ahead of time, I'm going to do something, and then they go do it, and then they look back later and say, oh, there are all these clues, all these red flags, and we didn't notice them. I think we have to get a lot better at noticing those red flags and taking some preemptive action.
Yes, yes, and with that, intervention immediately. Yeah. But here's my question, Patrick. I am all about preserving relationships, and I think that's one of our biggest lessons in this life is in relationships with each other. And so my question to you is, you know, let's take, for instance, the abortion issue. Can I disagree with someone and still accept them? At what level of acceptance? I think it has to do with almost like a prayerful and mature adult that can say, I can still love you, I can still pray for you, and I can still have you in my life, brother or sister, even though I disagree with you. What is the lesson here in relationship to disagreeing with someone but still accepting them and having them in your life?
I think it's a beautiful ideal, Mary. I really do. And if you're one of those people who is adept at doing that, all the more I admire you for that. I don't know that most people, or maybe not most people, I don't know that many people can do that, because the strain of this ideological gulf between them, let's say on something like abortion, can be so front and center that it just seems to ruin the togetherness that you might otherwise have, or you just never talk about it. But knowing that somebody would countenance killing an unborn life, an unborn human in abortion, I mean, I think most people, it kind of changes the way you look at that person, and it lessens your estimation of that person if you realize, well, she really does believe it's okay to kill innocent people. She wouldn't put it that way, but that's what it amounts to. So because we're frail, it seems that maybe for many people, they can't achieve that kind of serenity that you're talking about that would allow you to have some kind of a friendship or relationship with people. I don't think it's possible for some of us anyway. But here's another thing to consider in light of what you're saying, Mary. Jesus gave a paradigm for this in Matthew chapter 18, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, but where he talks about if you have something against your brother, go to him in private and see if you can reason with him. And if you can, great, you've won over your brother. If you can't, he says, bring two or three witnesses, try it that way. If that doesn't work, he says, tell it to the church. And then he says, and if he won't listen even to the church, then treat him like a Gentile or a tax collector. And that's a Hebraism, which means you get cut off. You now are excluded. And in a very real way, you would turn your back on that person. Now, Jesus doesn't give us what the specific example he might have had in mind of what the person was doing wrong. But the principle there, I think, at least in some cases, might mean that you can't have a relationship with somebody who is in some active way going against the truth. Where that line is, I don't know. And if you're able to preserve something good for as long as possible, I think that's great. I just don't think a lot of people can do that.